I next met with Dr. Michael Postow, and to begin, I asked him to explain why there's such synergy between BRAF and MEK inhibitors.
So melanomas are really driven by a signaling cascade within cells called the MAP kinase pathway. And there are many different mutations that can be found along the MAP kinase pathway. Approximately 40 or 50% of those patients will have a mutation in the oncogene BRAF. About 20% will have a mutation in a protein that's upstream called NRAS. So BRAF inhibitors inhibit the MAP kinase pathway by blocking that mutant BRAF. And when that's blocked, that shuts down the MAP kinase pathway in BRAF mutant cells. So we see some efficacy there. BRAF is upstream of another protein called MEK, M-E-K, and MEK inhibitors like trametinib or cobimetinib block downstream of BRAF within the MAP kinase pathway. And so it's the theory that dual blockade of this particular MAP kinase pathway, both with oncogenic BRAF and also downstream with MEK, two blocking proteins within the same pathway, that dual blockade is believed to be part of why we may be seeing some increased efficacy of this approach in combination as opposed to just BRAF inhibition alone.
Could you talk a little bit about the data set that was behind the approval of this combination and how these data compare to other similar combinations? The one that I'm familiar with is vemurafenib and cobimetinib.
So dabrafenib and trametinib were initially approved by the FDA based upon improved response rate and progression-free survival in a very large phase 1-2 study, and they were approved for use in combination based upon those early data results. Fortunately, over time, what we've seen for dabrafenib and trametinib is that in addition to improved response rate and progression-free survival, the final data from the COMBI-D study, which is a phase 3 double-blinded study that was randomized for patients to receive dabrafenib and trametinib or dabrafenib alone, the overall survival analysis has now been completed for that study and was reported at ASCO just this past year in 2015 and subsequently published as well, demonstrating that dabrafenib and trametinib has improved overall survival compared to dabrafenib alone. And therefore, now based on this overall survival benefit of dabrafenib and trametinib over dabrafenib alone, we really do have more confidence in the BRAF and MEK backbone dabrafenib and trametinib over dabrafenib alone. Additionally, dabrafenib and trametinib in a separate randomized phase 3 study has been shown to have improved overall survival compared to vemurafenib as monotherapy. So now we have two randomized large phase studies showing dabrafenib and trametinib can improve overall survival both compared to dabrafenib alone and compared to vemurafenib alone. However, vemurafenib is now being combined with cobimetinib. Cobimetinib is not yet approved by the FDA. However, vemurafenib and cobimetinib, the BRAF and MEK inhibitor combination, has also been shown to improve progression-free survival compared to vemurafenib monotherapy. And so it will be of interest to see how effective vemurafenib and cobimetinib can be in combination and how side effects may differ between that particular BRAF and MEK inhibitor combo compared to dabrafenib and trametinib.
Right now, what do we know about the comparative tolerability of the two combinations?
So dabrafenib and trametinib causes more febrile reactions as those that this patient particularly had experienced. Vemurafenib and cobimetinib seem to have less fevers and chills, so perhaps that may be an advantage to vemurafenib and cobimetinib. Vemurafenib in and of itself, perhaps with cobimetinib, is slightly less, but vemurafenib has more skin toxicity than dabrafenib does as monotherapy, and so that might be a bit of a specific side effect to vemurafenib in and of itself. But hopefully, cobimetinib in combination with vemurafenib will be better from a fever standpoint, and that appears to be the most particularly problematic issue with dabrafenib and trametinib.
If cobimetinib were approved right now, or the combination were approved, would you consider switching a patient, particularly if there were persistent problems with fever, to this other combination?
If cobimetinib were approved, and particularly if it were approved in combination with vemurafenib, for any patients that couldn't tolerate dabrafenib and trametinib, I would absolutely change them to vemurafenib and cobimetinib. Overall, I would probably still lean toward starting patients with dabrafenib and trametinib to see if it were tolerable, only because that particular combination has a clear overall survival benefit that's now been proven in two phase 3 studies. Our hope certainly is that vemurafenib and cobimetinib additionally as a combination can demonstrate improved overall survival with longer follow-up. And I think that's all of our hope. But at the moment, I would probably start with dabrafenib and trametinib, see if it was tolerable. If it was intolerable, then perhaps switch.
To what extent is there a survival tail on the curve with these combinations? Are there patients who are living years? I mean, even the possibility of cure, is that out there?
So with the BRAF and MEK inhibitor combinations, we do see that there is still a tail that's developing with progression-free survival. So we've seen that with the long-term data follow-up from the COMBI-D study, as we were talking about the improved overall survival benefit with dabrafenib and trametinib over dabrafenib alone. There does seem to be a tail that's emerging several years now into treatment. The median follow-up in that particular study was 20 months. So we don't have years and years and years and years of experience with this particular combination yet. But our hope is that, as is true for immunotherapies, there are a group of patients that have BRAF mutant melanoma that are on BRAF inhibitors or BRAF and MEK inhibitors that additionally can have this long-term benefit. Whether it's approximately 20-30% is kind of the neighborhood that we're seeing as far as that tail. But we're hoping that that type of a tail can persist for many, many more additional years.
Let's talk about your 33-year-old man.
So this was a young gentleman, a 33-year-old man that had a history of stage 3 melanoma from the past that was removed from axillary lymph nodes. And this patient was undergoing surveillance after resection of this high-risk disease. I believe he was approximately 2 years into the surveillance program when the detection of asymptomatic small pulmonary nodules was seen bilaterally. Now, this patient did not have any brain metastases. We had a brain MRI as part of routine staging, did not have any brain metastases. And we wanted to prove histologically that these small asymptomatic lung metastases were indeed melanoma. They were suspicious radiographically, but he underwent a lung biopsy. And after confirmation of metastatic melanoma on lung biopsy, we were approached with initial frontline treatment.
He was BRAF negative?
This patient had no BRAF mutation. So with no BRAF mutation, no brain metastases, clearly this was a patient for immunotherapy. So the initial conversation with this patient for immunotherapy was, in this asymptomatic patient, relatively low volume disease that was detected on routine surveillance of prior stage 3 melanoma, do we consider this patient for monotherapy with one of the anti-PD-1 drugs, nivolumab or pembrolizumab, or do we offer this patient combination therapy with an anti-PD-1 agent, nivolumab in this particular case, in combination with ipilimumab? And just as a reminder, that particular combination is not yet approved by the FDA, however, was available to this particular patient in the context of an expanded access program.
What did you decide to do?
So for this particular patient, we offered him the combination, and he wanted to be very aggressive. He wanted to take both drugs up front, and we offered them to him because he was otherwise a good candidate. It's a good conversation to have with this kind of particular patient to decide, you know, who really is appropriate for this combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab versus single agent with an anti-PD-1 approach. And I think the jury still remains out in terms of the overall survival of combinatorial therapy with ipilimumab and nivolumab versus either one of these antibodies alone. And without overall survival benefit, what we're left with are response rate differences and progression-free survival differences. And so with the combination, it seems that the response rates are quite high and the progression-free survival is quite good. Both are statistically significantly better than ipilimumab monotherapy. So ipilimumab monotherapy wasn't really a part of the discussion for this particular patient. And although it's not a statistical endpoint from the phase 3 study that was presented at ASCO this year, 2015, of the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab versus either the antibodies alone, the progression-free survival of the combination did numerically seem to be a bit higher than nivolumab monotherapy. And so all this patient really needed to hear was that outcomes were a little bit better with the combination in terms of responses and progression-free survival versus any of the antibodies by themselves. And he said, if I experience more side effects, which are expected with the combination compared to any approach by themselves, you know, he said he'd be able to want to go through with it. And he wanted to be very aggressive, and therefore he elected to proceed with the combination in an expanded access protocol.
Could you go back through your own vision for the biology of how these checkpoint inhibitors work and why you might expect synergy?
So these checkpoint inhibitors essentially disinhibit T cells to allow them to exert their anti-tumor immune response. So T cells, as part of a normal immune response, are important in policing the body, destroying bacteria, destroying viruses, and destroying cancers. and T cells to be normally regulated have turn-on signals and turn-off signals. And the ways you make T cells go more is by one of two strategies. You either turn on the turn-on signals or you turn off the turn-off signals. So both ipilimumab and the anti-PD-1 antibodies work by blocking the turn-off signals on T cells and thereby disinhibiting T cells to exert their anti-tumor effect. So ipilimumab targets a molecule called cytotoxic T lymphocyte antigen 4, or CTLA-4, and nivolumab and pembrolizumab, the anti-PD-1 antibodies, target the programmed cell death 1 receptor, or PD-1. And PD-1 and ipilimumab are different molecules on T cells, and so the theory is that by blocking both of these turn-off signals, you may get, hopefully, at least additive efficacy as compared to blocking either one of these turn-off signals alone. And so it really shows us that these mechanisms that both anti-CTLA-4 and anti-PD-1 have on T-cell biology, they're non-redundant. So blocking CTLA-4 may be insufficient to get the full effect. You may also need to block PD-1. And so due to the non-redundancy of the biology of these particular targets, blocking both may have at least additive effect, and we certainly hope synergistic effect as well. But they act at different points in the immune cascade as well. CTLA-4 acts very early in the activation stage of T cells, and PD-1 acts more distantly when the T cells are more in the effector phase, trying to destroy the tumors. And so by acting at multiple steps in the immune response, and by acting on multiple different targets that have non-redundant biologic features, that's how we hope that dual blockade may be more effective than either single agent blockade by itself.
How about anti-PD-L1 antibodies? What's the difference biologically, and what do we know about it clinically?
So anti-PD-L1 antibodies are also in clinical investigation. None of the anti-PD-L1 antibodies are yet approved for treatment of patients with metastatic melanoma or other cancers at this particular moment, but certainly we're seeing efficacy for anti-PD-L1 antibody approaches. What approach would be better still is going to remain unknown for quite some time. Anti-PD-L1 is a bit different than anti-PD-1. When you block anti-PD-1, you block anti-PD-1's interactions with two of its ligands, PD-L1 and PD-L2. When you block PD-L1, you block PD-L1's interactions with anti-PD-1 and other interactions between the PD-L1 ligand and other immune receptors. And so it remains unclear whether or not blocking PD-1 or PD-L1 is better. I think there are many theories as to side effect profiles or efficacy that may be different between blocking one or the other. We don't yet quite have enough information to really say one way is more effective than another. We certainly have much more mature data in melanoma at this point, blocking anti-PD-1 than blocking anti-PD-L1, but certainly both are very promising approaches, and we hope that anti-PD-L1 may also be a very interesting target in melanoma and is certainly an interesting target in many other malignancies. And it may be true that we need to block both, so anti-PD-L1 blockade and anti-PD-1 blockade.
And am I correct in saying that anti-PD-L1 antibodies block the PD-L1 ligand, but anti-PD-1 antibodies block the receptor?
Exactly right.
And that's why by blocking the receptor, essentially it's going to relate to PD-1 and PD-2. Or PD-L1 or PD-2?
Right. If you block the receptor, PD-1, you block this receptor, PD-1's interactions with both of its ligands, PD-L1 and PD-L2. So blocking PD-1, you get blockade of both its interactions with PD-L1 and PD-L2. How important it is to block PD-L2, we don't really quite know yet, but certainly with anti-PD-1 antibody therapy, you block its interactions with both of its ligands. With anti-PD-L1, you only block the anti-PD-L1 PD-1 interaction, but PD-L1 also interacts with other receptors beyond PD-1, and whether that also can be a part of the anti-tumor efficacy of anti-PD-L1 antibodies, I think remains to be seen, but certainly anti-PD-L1 antibodies are very promising as well.
So this man goes on the combination of Ipi and Nivo. What happened?
So this gentleman went on the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab, and after his first dose of combination therapy, he felt entirely well. After his second dose, which happens 3 weeks later, he began having fevers and chills, and his fevers weren't so high, not as high as the degree we may see with BRAF and MEK inhibitors like dabrafenib and trametinib, but lower grade fevers, 100.6, 101, having some chills. So when any patient has this type of cytokine type appearance, we want to make sure that their laboratory parameters look okay. And this particular patient, after a couple of doses of combinatorial immune checkpoint blockade with ipilimumab and nivolumab, did have a transaminitis, elevation of the aspartate transaminase and alanine transaminase, or AST and ALT. And this patient had a quite high elevation. He ended up going about 8 times normal on both of his liver function tests. His bilirubin and alkaline phosphatase remained entirely normal, so this was a pure transaminitis associated with this self-resolving febrile episode. And for this particular patient, we ended up having to treat his transaminitis, which is a relatively common side effect of this particular combination. We treated him with prednisone at 60 milligrams daily.
And what happened, and what was going on with the tumor?
So we first knew that it was a bit early. He had only had 2 doses of immune checkpoint blockade, and so we hadn't done a CAT scan yet. However, we did treat him with steroids, and with steroid use in this particular case, he had resolution of his LFT abnormality, and it did take a couple of weeks to resolve. And so he was on steroids for about 3 weeks, which is typical course for patients that have this transaminitis. And we slowly tapered him off of 3 weeks, and his LFT abnormality resolved. He had no further fevers. And then at the end of this 3-week course, we ended up performing a CT scan. It was only 2 doses of treatment, and typically patients try to get 4 doses of the combination of both antibodies if they're not having side effects. But this particular patient now with this fever and LFT abnormality and requiring steroid use, we wanted to check to see what anti-tumor immune efficacy that we had seen before we were even to think about more treatment in this particular patient. And remarkably, this patient had a complete response on a CT scan. So complete disappearance of all of these pulmonary nodules. Now, these were all very small pulmonary nodules, all around 1 centimeter, some less. However, all of these completely responded. And so certainly he was thrilled. Certainly in his case, he seems to believe it was absolutely worth having some fevers and this laboratory abnormality and being on steroids for about 3 weeks. But he's now off steroids and having a complete response just after 2 doses of this combination. And I really think that gets into a question of a couple of instructive concepts with this combination. And one of them is that how much treatment is delivered doesn't necessarily really matter. Now, this is true for the combination. This is true for PD-1 alone. This is true for ipilimumab alone, frankly, in that 4 doses of ipilimumab was somewhat arbitrary and that it's really unclear how much of this we need to give. And so when we give it to the point that an immune system has been activated and an anti-tumor response has been seen, we may not need to push it just to check the box that we've given all 4 doses. And in this particular patient, he had a nice response just after 2 doses of the combination. And it also really reminds us that treating a side effect with an immunosuppressant like prednisone doesn't necessarily inhibit the efficacy of these drugs. And we've done a number of studies that have shown that patients that need immunosuppressants to treat side effects don't have worse outcomes than those that don't need immunosuppressants. And so really the general rule is treat the side effect, get the patient through it, and hope for a good response. Now, you know, unfortunately, it's not all patients that have a benefit like this, but in this particular case, he had a great benefit.
So did you reinstitute treatment, and what's going on with him right now?
So we haven't reinstituted treatment. I think we would be okay to reinstitute treatment if we needed to. His side effect was, I would call, moderate. I think certainly not severe. His only symptoms were a little bit of a low-grade fever. He's 33, otherwise healthy, tolerated it fine from a symptomatic standpoint. And his blood test was essentially an asymptomatic laboratory abnormality in and of itself. He had no liver pain, liver symptoms, liver function problems. So this was just a bit of a hepatitis alongside a fever. So I would potentially consider this patient for retreatment in the future if he were to need it. But the real question is whether or not this patient needs it. And that our hope is that this complete response that this patient's had will remain durable for a long time. And in the phase 3 study that was presented by Jed Walchak at ASCO in 2015, one of the most important aspects of that particular trial is that the median duration of response in patients has not yet been reached. Follow-up time is certainly only approximately a year at this particular point, so we don't have years and years and years of follow-up to say that these responses can last 5, 8, 10 years yet. However, we do know from the ipilimumab experience alone that some of the responses can last for that long, and it's our hope for anti-PD-1 and combinations with PD-1 agents and ipilimumab that responses such as the complete response this patient had can continue to last for years and years and years, and maybe this patient won't need any more treatment. We've certainly had other patients that remain a year and a half without any treatment at all after these kinds of immune therapy approaches. So I'm going to hold treatment for this patient until it seems that there's any sense that the tumors are starting to act again, and at that point certainly we'll reinstitute him with immunotherapy.
How long has he been off therapy right now?
He's been off for a couple months now, so he is still relatively fresh. Our hope is that this will last for a very long time, but he's still relatively fresh.
How do you explain the persistent presence of remission in these patients after they've gone off therapy? Do you see persistent immunologic changes? Do you think it's something happens that pushes them back into a state where they can control the tumor? What do you think is going on?
So it's a really good question, because it's one of the remarkable aspects of immune therapy that after treatment and treatment discontinuation, how do these responses maintain themselves? And so the drugs certainly are metabolized and out of the body in weeks, so the drug presence can't really be the explanation. However, one of the theories is that with the tumor destruction that happens when the T cells are turned on by these antibodies, what then happens is that the immune system has a secondary activation of itself. So you give the drugs, the T cells are better T cells, destroy the tumor, and that through that tumor destruction, antigen presentation, the immune system primes itself and therefore creates its own anti-tumor immune efficacy that can persist independent of the persistence of the drug. So it's just getting that patient to have that tumor response, and then their own memory response may continue this activation. The other thing we know is that the anti-PD-1 antibodies remain on T cells for quite some time, and even after the drug itself is metabolized out of the system, the pharmacodynamic effect on T cells may be persistent for quite some time after the even drug has been metabolized or the free drug has been metabolized. And so I think it's a combination of these features may account for this durability.
Can you try to put more in perspective the efficacy, at least at this point, of the combination versus single agent? You know, somehow when you look at response rates or even CR rates, I don't know, it's kind of hard to bring in. I was even wondering if you all tried to calculate a total amount of tumor and, you know, like a one waterfall plot for the entire, you know what I mean? Like the amount of tumor bulk that actually gets reduced. Can you try to put that in perspective?
Absolutely. So we have response rates, but as we're all aware, response rate in and of itself is a technical term for clinical trials designating patients that have tumor burden reduction of 30% or greater. So what do we know beyond that one single definition of quote-unquote response rate? We know that a vast number of patients will have tumor shrinkage beyond that 30% mark. So on both sides, number one, beyond the percentage of patients that are quoted in these studies, which is approximately for the combination 55 to 60%, there will be a larger percentage of patients that will have some degree of tumor shrinkage that didn't make that 30% cutoff. And therefore, those patients are not technically counted as responders, but the drug is clearly working in a patient that shrinks their tumor burden by 25%. And that patient may not have otherwise been considered a responder. So certainly the quote-unquote percentage of patients that have benefit from these antibodies exceeds the traditional response rate in and of itself. So what do we know about what's called depth of response or how much these tumors are shrinking? It seems numerically that with the combination, the median tumor burden reduction is quite high and numerically higher than anti-PD-1 by itself. So it seems that anti-PD-1 by itself has a median tumor reduction of quite a good degree. However, with the combination, it seems that that median tumor reduction may be a bit higher with the combination approach. Certainly, both are much greater than ipilimumab monotherapy, and therefore, ipilimumab monotherapy is a bit falling out of favor initially as a single agent for first-line treatment. But when patients ask, you know, doc, is this drug going to work for me? I think we can really say that the majority of cases, yes, this will work, because the response rate in and of itself is greater than 50%, at least for the combination approach. And yet there are even more patients that will have tumor shrinkage. So I think there's a much greater percent of people that have benefit than we can even attest in the response rate.
What about toxicity with the combination? Sort of globally, kind of, I think what I've heard is qualitatively, you see the same kinds of things as with Ipi, just more of it. Is that the case?
Right. So it seems that the side effect in terms of qualitative side effects, in terms of what we're seeing, seems to be similar to prior experiences with either ipilimumab alone or PD-1 alone. But with the combination, I do think that they're just more frequent. And that's been borne out from phase 1 studies, phase 2 studies of the combination, phase 3 studies of the combination. The rate of grade 3 or 4 side effects with the combination is much higher than either antibody alone, certainly higher than anti-PD-1 antibodies alone, which is even less than ipilimumab alone. So I think the combination side effect profile is perhaps the reason to pause for certain patients. And we're still trying to figure out who it's worth it to give the combination for, given that side effect profile. Most side effects are recoverable with immunosuppression. So even if side effects happen, most people do get through it. But the side effects that can happen are typically rash. Some people will develop diarrhea or colitis, which is, again, one of the side effects that can be seen with ipilimumab alone or anti-PD-1 antibodies alone, certainly much to a lesser degree with anti-PD-1 antibodies alone. Liver inflammation is in this one particular patient's case. Some people will have some neurologic side effects, such as aseptic meningitis or encephalitis, and so that should be considered in patients with altered mental status or headache and neck stiffness. And these patients do get better with steroids. And then endocrinopathy is another notable side effect in that patients that have headache or feeling fatigued, they should be evaluated for thyroid function status and evaluated for pituitary axis dysfunction, because sometimes the hormone glands can be inflamed in these particular patients and they need hormone replacement therapy, and they can certainly feel better with hormone replacement therapy. But side effects in general for the combination, more frequent than either monotherapy, not necessarily different in character, more frequently occurring in number.
What about pneumonitis?
Pneumonitis can definitely happen. I think one of the principles is that pneumonitis, fortunately, in severe cases, is only in the single-digit percentages. It is important to keep this in mind because in early clinical studies, it has resulted in treatment fatalities. So it is a particular important side effect to be mindful of. And if you're treating a patient really with any of these immune checkpoint blocking antibodies and they have shortness of breath, feeling like they have the flu, upper respiratory symptoms, cough, these patients should be aggressively imaged with at least a chest x-ray, perhaps even a chest CT scan. And if pneumonitis is seen, immunosuppressants like steroids should be given. And it's important to be mindful of pneumonitis, given the fact it could be severe. It seems of interest in the phase 3 study, with the combination, there were no treatment-related deaths of the combination approach, and there were treatment-related deaths in either the monotherapy. So I cannot say necessarily that the combination has a higher rate of treatment-related fatalities than either antibody by itself. But pneumonitis does remain an important side effect and something that we need to keep in mind.
Have you actually had patients who had pneumonitis? And what's the clinical syndrome? What do you see?
So with pneumonitis, patients will come into clinic and sometimes they'll even call before they're coming into clinic because shortness of breath is a particularly disturbing side effect. And so patients will be having cough or just feeling dyspneic at home and call us and just say, you know, doc, I just feel a little tired. And, you know, go up the stairs of feeling winded or just kind of walking down the street and feeling a little more short of breath. Those patients we really need to refer to an emergency room, and sometimes we'll refer them to our urgent care facility or local emergency rooms and encourage them to have chest x-rays and chest CTs. And then what we'll see is a bit of a haziness, and there are a number of different radiographic appearances of pneumonitis, and so it may not be so obvious, but it is very different radiographically than a typical lobar pneumonia in patients with community-acquired pneumonia. So it's often more of ground glass opacities, diffuse interstitial changes on chest CT bilaterally, or faint kind of reticular nodular appearances on chest x-ray and chest CT. And when we see that, we just start treatment immediately with steroids. And it's remarkable how much better patients can feel very, very quickly.
Do you get tissue? Do you try to biopsy? And what do you see if you do biopsy?
Some patients with very, very significant pneumonitis, we have had to refer for bronchoscopy and biopsy because it remains unclear whether or not this is an infectious picture or if this is an inflammatory picture. And before we introduce high-dose immunosuppression for these patients, we do want to ensure that there is no infection going on, particularly if this is a patient that might be at risk for infection otherwise. And so we have done some biopsies in some patients and bronchoscopies, And there can be a number of different inflammatory changes histologically that can be seen in these particular patients. And typically our pathologists have been able to say that it's not clear that there's a particular histologic pattern that's characterized by these pneumonitis episodes. It'll remain to be seen whether or not a particular histologic pattern falls out in terms of what types of pathologic changes are seen in these patients with pneumonitis. But usually the pathologists can say drug-related changes, and after bronchoscopy, you can be more comfortable saying there's no infection going on, that, you know, bronchoalveolar lavage has excluded any other obvious infections, viral syndromes, bacterial infections, or even fungal infections, and therefore then you can really begin higher dose immunosuppression for patients that are really particularly affected by these treatments.
What about colitis? Of course, we were sensitized to this from IPI. What do you see typically in terms of the syndrome, and how much diarrhea or colitis does it take for you to take action?
Diarrhea and colitis, which are independent side effects, at least graded differently in the criteria in the clinical trials, diarrhea just being frequency of bowel movements, and then colitis being a separate entity of really colonic inflammation, bloody stools, abdominal pain, that type of a syndrome. They are certainly on a spectrum with overlap, but we see both with combination treatment. We've seen both with ipilimumab alone from prior experience, and we've seen both with anti-PD-1 as well, certainly to a lesser degree with anti-PD-1 alone. So what happens when a patient has diarrhea or colitis? Typically, they'll call in with difference in their bowel habits. It's not something that patients come for treatment, get the treatment, and then on their way home in the car, they're having diarrhea. So it's not really a infusion-related type reaction. It's something that typically sets in a number of weeks after treatment initiation, even often after a couple of doses of treatment. And patients will call in from home just saying that they're having diarrhea. And it's important that they maintain their hydration. It's important that they feel comfortable calling their physician with this type of symptom. And we really invite people to call us with these symptoms because we know if they don't call us and the symptoms persist or worsen, it's much harder to treat. So we like to nip this in the bud and treat with steroids early and aggressively in these particular patients. Sometimes change in diet or hydration alone or antidiarrheals can be sufficient for very mild cases. But anyone that's having more severe diarrhea really should be started on prednisone. And we start with a pretty good dose of prednisone, about 1 mg/kg. And when patients start feeling better, then we taper off of prednisone. If patients really aren't getting better with prednisone, then we typically either refer them to the hospital for intravenous steroids or consideration for the anti-tumor necrosis alpha blocking antibody infliximab. And certainly patients that have gotten infliximab can get better very quickly if steroids initially are unsatisfactory in resolving their diarrhea.
So let's finish out talking a little bit about adjuvant therapy and particularly trials in the adjuvant setting. Can you present your 52-year-old lady and not only talk about what happened with her on the trial she went in, but how you would approach patients like this outside of a trial? And again, stage 3 resected melanoma on adjuvant trial, BRAF versus placebo. We were blinded. She developed mild rash, joint aches, and some skin growths. Does that ring a bell?
Yes, absolutely. So this was a woman, a middle-aged woman, 52 years old, otherwise healthy. She was diagnosed with stage 3 melanoma, had melanoma in a lymph node. And her disease was completely surgically resected. She had undergone a completion lymph node dissection for melanoma and inguinal lymph nodes.
Where was the primary?
Primary was on her leg, and it had spread to the inguinal lymph nodes. So she was stage 3 melanoma, completely resected, no evidence of disease. And so her options after that initial stage 3 diagnosis were the FDA-approved drug interferon, observation, which is a reasonable approach as well, or clinical trials. And we tested her melanoma in the lymph node for the presence of a BRAF mutation. We found she had the BRAF V600E mutation, which is the most common type of BRAF mutation. And given this BRAF mutation, she was very interested in clinical trials, and she didn't want to go on interferon, and she didn't want to just be observed without active therapy. And so she was considering different clinical trials, and she signed up for a randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled trial of vemurafenib, the BRAF inhibitor, versus placebo. We really spoke with her quite a long time about the possibility that she could be receiving a placebo, and there's clinical equipoise in this particular decision because the adjuvant therapy for melanoma remains such a gray zone in terms of what patients may want to prefer and what's deemed to be acceptable on the provider level. And so she signed up for this particular trial, was treated with either vemurafenib or placebo.
And for how long was that going to be?
A year of therapy. And during her treatment, she developed some skin lesions. And I think with the appearance of these skin lesions, which is a classic side effect of emurafenib, these skin growths like keratoacanthomas, squamous cell carcinoma skin cancers can also be seen when BRAF inhibitors like vemurafenib are given as monotherapy. I think we would all somewhat have guessed that she was getting vemurafenib, although technically the study does remain blinded and these skin lesions could have happened even if she was receiving placebo. But these skin lesions were just very simply resected by dermatology, and she continued to complete her year of adjuvant therapy with vemurafenib or placebo on this particular study. And fortunately, she remains without evidence of recurrent disease. And she was very happy that she was able to have this opportunity. I think we all believed, and she had some reassurance that she was getting the BRAF inhibitor in this particular context. However, she could have been on placebo since it was a placebo-controlled trial. And we really don't know about the efficacy of BRAF inhibitors in the adjuvant setting. This was a study that tested vemurafenib versus placebo. There's another study that's being conducted testing dabrafenib and trametinib in combination versus placebo. And so, again, our hope certainly is that all of these studies continue to demonstrate efficacy in the stage 3 setting, as these drugs have for the stage 4 setting or unresectable stage 3 patients. But the data still remain unknown, and we're hopeful that with more time we will see positive results from this adjuvant approach of these adjuvant BRAF inhibitors, but we don't yet know. So we encourage patients to continue to participate in ongoing clinical trials.
How much of a problem is sunburn in patients who are just getting vemurafenib, and what do you counsel patients?
So sunburn with vemurafenib is a really terrible side effect, and it's very important that patients that are taking vemurafenib monotherapy, as this patient likely was in this particular adjuvant clinical trial, to really be careful with the sun, use a lot of sunscreen, use hats, and just be careful being out in the sun, because vemurafenib, even perhaps more so than dabrafenib, can be associated with sun hypersensitivity, and patients can have very, very significant sunburns when they're taking vemurafenib.
Did she have any problem with it?
She was very careful with the sun, did not have any particular problem, so fortunately she did okay, and she minded our warnings on this topic, so she was okay.